Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk by meditation instructor Marcus Casey continues our examination of the book Ultimately Perfect by His Eminence Taisi Tu Rinpoche. Today we look at Chapter 3, Stress Management. We all experience stress. How should we deal with it? Listen to Taisi Tu Rinpoche's thoughts, including the ultimate goal to eliminate the need to manage stress by eliminating the stress completely. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. Thanks for braving the snow and leaving behind all the good sledding weather. That's what my kids are focused on today, anyway. So my name is Marcus Casey. I'm a volunteer meditation instructor here at Columbus KTC. And when our lamas are away, Lama Kathy and Lama Tom, teaching elsewhere, then some of the meditation instructors are asked to fill in, and we do book studies. And right now we are alternating between two different books. The one we're doing today is called Ultimately Perfect by Taisi Tu Rinpoche, one of the teachers in our lineage. And then on other weeks we do the history of the Karmapas, and we're going through a lot of our lineage teachers in past centuries, and it's very fascinating to read through those spiritual biographies, and there's always something inspiring and something you can learn from about your own practice from their lives. The Taisi Tu Rinpoche, who has written the text that we are reading today, is the 12th in the Taisi Tu Rinpoche, in the Taisi Tu lineage. It's one of the oldest lineages in our lineage, and it dates back to the 14th century, so at the time of the fifth Karmapa. And I don't know if you've ever heard a chance to hear him speak. There are some YouTube videos, things like that. He occasionally travels and came to the U.S. a couple years ago, I think. He is really full of humor, down to earth, and a lot of fun to hear speak. And it really comes out in his books, which have been edited together from his teachings. And fantastic, fantastic teacher. So to start, we usually say the four-line refuge prayer, which is a prayer of going for refuge in the three jewels, which are the Buddha, or the what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, or our guides and companions on the path. And then it is also a prayer of bodhicitta. So refuge and bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is the aspiration to practice and to wake up for the benefit of all beings. If you don't know it in Tibetan, then simply quiet your mind and listen along and make aspirations on your own. Om Sangje Chidang Tsoki Chognam La Jang Chu Bardu Dagni Kapsu Chi Dagi Jin Soki Pe Sunam Gi Dro La Pinchir Sangje Drupar Sho Sangje Chidang Tsoki Chognam La Jang Chu Bardu Dagni Kapsu Chi Dagi Jin Soki Pe Sunam Gi Dro La Pinchir Sangje Drupar Sho Sangje Chudang Toki Chonam La Jang chu bar du dag ni kyab su chi. Dag yi jin so ki pe su nam gi. Dro la pen chir sang je du par sho. Okay, thank you. So today we're going to talk about something that, you know, most of you can probably get up and leave because it doesn't apply to you at all. We're going to talk about stress and stress management. So Taisi Chu Rinpoche was asked by students to discuss stress management, and he did. Now, Buddhism is nothing if not practical. The Buddha did not develop his teachings from a set of dogmas or philosophies or mythologies. He began his teaching from his own experience and from years of working with his mind and from the ultimate clarity he received when he awoke and recognized the nature of mind. So the topic of today, stress management, comes out of a long tradition of eons of working with the mind and examining the mind, and the practical instructions developed by those who have done this and become masters in working with the mind. Taisi Chu Rinpoche starts out by saying that it is quite common for people in modern society to struggle with stress. He talks a little bit about the word stress, and he says he doesn't have a single word for it. We often call it stress, but one person's difficulty may not be the same as another person's difficulty, and things work differently for different people. So what we call stress is probably a broad term, but usually what we are referring to when we refer to stress is the condition in which people get tired, people get confused, and people get overwhelmed by other people's expectations or their own expectations of themselves, all kinds of things which ultimately become unreasonable. So we try to get rid of it. The first teaching that the Buddha taught after he woke up was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. Every sentient being, as long as we're not free, then we are not exempt from the suffering and that pervades our entire life and our entire existence. It's basically the nature of our minds as unawakened beings is the nature of suffering. Taisi Chu Rinpoche says that he is sure that the suffering referred to in the First Noble Truth includes stress. In our modern world, we recognize the wisdom of slowing down, relaxing, and developing a peaceful mind. And yet, it seems like we're all struggling with the same things. We're all trying to manage our stress all the time. Rinpoche points out that we take sleeping pills, we go to therapy, we go to religious leaders, to doctors, we read books, podcasts, all kinds of services to help us do something that we're struggling to do ourselves. We go to others, and in some cases, we're looking for a quick solution or someone to do it for us, right? He also points out that there's a very physical aspect to stress. And I want us to all think about this. While we are in this body, our minds are very linked to our physical body, and our mental health is very linked to our physical body. And so for many of us, stress has a feeling, or maybe it's a feeling of pain, because when we are stressed, we end up with tight muscles and headaches, things like that. So the first thing I actually want you to do is take a minute And just as an exercise in mindfulness, visualize what stress feels like in your body. We're not going to talk about this, so don't worry about trying to prepare an answer. But for yourself, just kind of visualize what stress feels like to you. Let's take one quick minute and do kind of a body scan and kind of even visualize a stressful situation that you've been in recently and kind of try to feel that in your body. Okay, so I don't want to spend too long on that. Kind of an unpleasant thing, but I do that as kind of a little practice because when you're going through stress, doing that kind of body scan and recognizing where that is, for me, you know, holding shoulders tense, right? And that ends up leading to a headache. Sometimes I'll have the mindfulness to catch that early on in the day. And I'll realize that I've got my shoulders held up tense, and just the mere act of taking a moment to breathe and to relax can actually prevent a headache hours later just because of that one moment of mindfulness. So that's kind of the reason I do that. So I would challenge you tomorrow, or whatever day the stress comes, this afternoon, maybe you can hold out till Tuesday. When it comes, try to recognize it. Try to do a quick little mental scan of your physical body, and try to recognize that and take a moment to relax. Rinpoche says that when you're physically tense, your blood does not circulate or flow properly, your muscles don't function properly, and your nervous system doesn't function properly, and therefore it becomes worse and worse. You get used to certain physical conditions, including postures, breathing, and the way you put pressure on different parts of the body. And so the flow of energy and the flow of something as simple as blood circulation is affected, and your oxygen becomes out of balance. As a result of that, you don't necessarily have the necessary energy, and you're not able to do what you should normally be able to do physically. So at the time then that we end up with needing the most energy because things are overwhelming, we end up with a lack of energy because of these habits that we develop during stress. So I told you this would be practical, right? Rinpoche really gets down to the science of it. So he says that when you exercise, do physical therapy, watch your diet, all these things do help to a degree. And he encourages you to do these things. But he says that although exercise and therapy, physical therapy, things like that work, they don't work very deeply. And he points out that you can be very physically fit and very mentally fit, but still have stress. He said you can have all kinds of problems and have stress, which is understandable, but you can also have no problems at all and still have stress. And he says he knows people who don't have to work and they don't have responsibilities and they don't have children and jobs, but they have a lot of stress and they're always tired. He said he knows people who have many responsibilities and work and children and things, but they're not stressed. So, and he said, I'm not even talking about spiritual people, just ordinary people who have a full-time job, work hard, and have no stress at all. And so he says that even though we do all these things that we're taught to do, exercise and physical therapy and mental therapy and things like that, it doesn't take care of all of it, although they're good things, and he doesn't discourage those things at all. Now, Taisichu Rinpoche says that the capacity of our minds cannot be compared to anything. It is incomparable. The only suitable example, he says, is that the mind is like the sky. There is no boundary or capacity for the mind. How much you can know, how much you cannot know, how much you want and how much you don't want, there is no limit to its capacity. And teachers often say this as a very encouraging thing. We have limitless potential, and we have the potential to wake up. But when it comes to stress, Taisichu Rinpoche says, there's no end and there's no boundary to what kind of form stress can take. Because the capacity of mind has no boundary, therefore the capacity for the manifestation of stress has no boundary. But don't worry, there's good news coming. But, you know, this is the nature of our minds. The nature of our minds is limitlessness and completely without boundary. There's a, we mentioned earlier that stress is part of the First Noble Truth, that life always contains suffering, and that stress is part of that suffering. Fortunately, there are four noble truths, and the Buddha also taught ways to tackle the particular impossibleness of the suffering of sentient beings, and so that also includes stress. There's a Tibetan saying, a king cries in his palace, a beggar cries under a tree, but the tears are the same. Now, the beggar may cry because he hasn't had anything to eat for days. He's destitute. He may not have anything to wear. He may be sitting under a tree and crying because he has completely lost everything. Whereas a king has countless robes, hundreds of courses of cuisine. Rinpoche says old-time kings had hundreds of queens, thousands of servants, hundreds of cooks, and their kitchens could be the size of 100 beggars' homes. But a king still cries for something, and that something is stress. In this way, it is impossible to fulfill the wishes of a sentient being. It is impossible to fulfill the wishes of one person if that person does not decide to be content. And I'll say that again because I stumbled over it the first time and it's just worth repeating. It is impossible to fulfill the wishes of one person if that person does not decide to be content. So I think what Taisichu Rinpoche here is pointing out is that there's intention involved here, and we need to intend to be content. And without that, if we don't make that intention and then follow through on the methods that will help us with that, we never will be content. So there's an element, I think, especially in our society, in which we don't so much examine the fact that contentment is a decision. We kind of have it built into our culture to always strive after what's next and what's next and what's next. Rinpoche points out that as human beings, we have managed to get rid of all of our big predators. He said, I told you there's humor. He says, big birds that can carry us and eat us are gone. Big lizards that can just pick us up and eat us like a sandwich are gone. All the dragons are slain. His words, not mine. Most of the tigers and lions are in cages, and we ride elephants and make them work for us. Now, we, of course, still have small predators that we're still dealing with, insects that spread disease and bacteria, all kinds of things like that. But we're making a lot of progress on those as well, right? We've managed to get rid of many of the things we don't like, at least externally. We have so many gadgets. We can fly from one part of the world to the other, and we can talk to people even if they're in space, literally. And yet, for all of our progress, we're not able to take care of our stress. He points out that we have solved many of our problems in the last 100 years, and yet the suicide rate is much higher than it was 100 years ago. We have much, yet we feel so desperate that we would rather die than live. Living becomes more frightening, more disliked, more unfavorable than dying. So people kill themselves because they think it is a better thing than living. This proves that all of our external things have not really accomplished anything toward making us happy. So in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha tells us how to handle this. He says the solution for fulfilling your wishes is in you, not somewhere else. The Buddha taught for many years after his awakening, and on many levels. He taught for about 50 years after his enlightenment. But this was his very first teaching. The translation for the term for Buddhist in Tibetan is Nangpa, and it translates as insider. And that doesn't refer to, we're in the club and these other people are outside of the club. Not that kind of insider. What it's talking about is that Buddhists are insiders because they work on themselves from the inside. It means that we have Buddha nature. Buddha is in us. The solution is in us. The potential is in us. It's not somewhere out there. So when we look for the solution out there, that's not the Buddha's teaching. And when we look for the solution in us, that is the Buddha's teaching. So getting back to talking about stress, we're not going to find the solution in changing our circumstances, although sometimes circumstances need to change. We're only going to find the solution by working on our own minds. Rinpoche says that if you're able to simply be at peace, then 50% of the stress is taken care of. You might have pain and pressure, things like that, but if you're at peace with yourself, then 50% of the stress is gone. It's transformed. He says that he himself has a terrible neck. Other people might have a terrible knee or throat or back. We have all kinds of things. Kids to feed, a lawsuit, insert your particular circumstance here. But if you are at peace in your mind, then you can manage all of that without much stress. If you are not at peace with yourself, then no matter your circumstance, even if you have no stress, no responsibilities, no financial worries, etc., if you don't get things your own way, then you will still have stress. The suffering will still be there. Now, the way of the Bodhisattva that we often teach on here by Shantideva, in there, he has a verse where he talks about a very common metaphor that Tibetans use. And it says, if you're walking on the path and it is very rocky, you can either try to cover the entire world with leather, or you can cover your own feet. Either one will accomplish the same thing. And that's what he's getting here. You can try to change all the circumstances in the world to suit you perfectly, in thinking that will make you happy, or you can work on your own mind. And because we do not experience the world ever apart from our own minds, working on our minds solves it all. I mentioned financial stress. Have you ever noticed all the problems that people who win the lottery seem to have? Right? You think you're dealing with all this financial stress. If I won the lottery, that would all just go away, right? But these are people that didn't have peace of mind before they won the lottery, and the lottery isn't going to do anything to change that. Some people gamble it all away. They spend it all on entertainment. They end up with fights and lawsuits with relatives and coworkers and things like that. Horrible things. I think there are even support groups for people who win the lottery, right? It's a difficult thing. So, changing your circumstances may sometimes be necessary, but it's a trap to constantly think that I will be happy when, .. I'll be peaceful when, .. He says that when we think like that, then we are creating the conditions for suffering all the time. He says the world is enormous and there is so much that by making conditions for our happiness with a few things, then we're creating the conditions for our suffering for everything else. He uses a metaphor of shooting at a target. So he says, you know, we create our own target. We create this big target and we make this little tiny bullseye in it. And then we put it as far away as possible, right? Because the further away it is, then when we hit the bullseye, that means we're a better shot, right? So we put that bullseye as far away as possible, this little tiny target, and we shoot and shoot. And wherever we hit, we're not happy because we're not hitting that bullseye. But it gets worse. Because if we hit the bullseye, what we actually do is just move the target back further and try to hit this new target, right? That's what we do. We get tired of that thing that we've been shooting for. Maybe it was some career or some job. Whatever our ambition is, if we end up accomplishing it, we become dissatisfied with that as well. And just push that target back further. This is the way we torture ourselves in samsara. And this is the habit that we have built up over countless lifetimes. So the first thing the Buddha teaches us is to develop peace within ourselves. And we develop peace through shamatha. No secret there, right? We teach shamatha at 10 a.m. every Sunday morning in our intro to meditation class. We have an hour of shamatha here in this room at 10 a.m. every Sunday. And there is a reason why we put that much emphasis on shamatha, because it really is the basis of everything else. Shamatha practice is normally sitting meditation. We assume a posture that is both stable and relaxed. We focus on an object, usually on our breath. I'm not going to go through all of the instructions for shamatha, but again, we teach them every week, so if you're not familiar with them, I highly recommend that you come to one of our classes. But we focus on that one object, on our breath, and as our breath goes in and out, without judgment and without trying to alter our breath in any way, we place our attention on our breath. And as our minds start to wander, because they will, we notice that, we drop the thought, we return our attention to the breath, and we keep doing that and practice that over and over. Rinpoche says, and this is honestly worth the price of admission today, Rinpoche says, it is helpful to our shamatha practice to create conditions that lead to success in meditation. And then he starts listing ways we can create conditions that are conducive to our meditative practice outside of the cushion. He says, you have to cut down on your greed, Because if you don't cut down on your greed, your shamatha practice will not really work. That sounds a lot like deciding to be content, doesn't it? You also have to cut down on your unnecessary activities. Be very mindful before you do something. Ask yourself if you really have to do these things. Are they necessary? He didn't say this, but do I really need to pick up my phone right now? Is it necessary? I'll throw that one in there because I teach to myself more than anyone else. He says moral discipline is also important. This refers to the fact that we are constantly entertaining our senses, and we should cut down on that. What is necessary, we do, but what is not necessary, if we have a serious habit with those things, we cannot stop them right away, but at least reduce them. And this actually gives our shamatha a good base. Otherwise, our shamatha can be very good in the shrine or on the cushion, but the minute we stand up from our cushion or step out of the shrine, we end up back in the same situation. If we live our lives to serve our senses, then that's what we'll return to as soon as we stand up from our meditative practice. He compares it to taking an aspirin for a headache. He said, it doesn't cure the headache, it just takes away the pain, and if the source of the headache remains, the headache will come back when the aspirin wears off. And that's what we do if we're not trying to adjust our lives and our lifestyles when we meditate. So if we create a good base for our shamatha practice by avoiding things that will hinder our peace of mind and develop the conditions that will be conducive to our peace of mind, whatever kind of shamatha practice we do will be effective. And not only will it be more effective, it will be more effective in a very lasting manner. Once you develop effective shamatha, you begin to see more clearly. And this leads to the next kind of meditation called vipassana. Vipassana means special insight. It is difficult without a peaceful mind developed through shamatha in order to have this special insight. But once you do, you are able to take the stressful circumstance and see it from a new perspective. This is the kind of special insight that vipassana gives. It allows you to get that perspective on your stressful circumstances and actually transform them. You will learn to see more clearly and gain insight and wisdom even from your most difficult circumstances. Now, the relationship between vipassana and shamatha, Rinpoche says, think of looking at yourself, at your face in a mirror. If you want to see your face clearly, then you have to have a clean mirror. Vipassana is like what you see, and shamatha is what cleans the mirror so that you can see what you see. So the most important condition for vipassana is shamatha. He says there are other conditions for vipassana. One is learning. He says, true vipassana is omniscience. He said, for us to expect to be omniscient in this lifetime is not really realistic. He calls it presumptuous. He says, if we want to be omniscient in this life, then we will at least have to live a life more like the Buddha lived, because we're not better than him, and he worked really hard. So living our kinds of lives, we can still develop vipassana, but we have to develop it through a lot of learning. He said we can learn it through books, through teachings, but also through living lineage. He says, you know, there are 100 Tibetan volumes that make up the teachings of the Buddha, the written teachings of the Buddha. We used to have them in a bookcase on our shrine. And we will again someday in the new building. And there are 200 volumes of commentaries on those 100 volumes. And we also had those. And we can learn from all these teachings. Our teachers produce books, we have more available to us in the way of teachings here in the West than we ever, ever have before. But we also learn from our teachers. We have Lama Kathy, we have Lama Tom, we have Kimpo Karcha Rinpoche, Thai Sithu Rinpoche, who we're learning from today, and His Holiness the 17th Karmapa, and many other great teachers. Rinpoche says, we learn through the tantras, which are the essence of the teachings. In Tibetan Buddhism, we tend to dive right into the practice without learning very much sometimes. But that's okay if we're doing it with faith and devotion. Because of the power of faith and devotion, it works. But if you don't have enough faith and devotion, then diving right into those practices without learning doesn't really work that much. So that kind of serious practice without doing some learning beforehand is only suitable for those who have unconditional devotion, like the kind of devotion that we learn about in this series that Milarepa had for his teacher Marpa, for example. If that kind of devotion is there, then you don't have to learn very much, he says. Just receive the transmission and practice, and it works. On the other hand, if you just get excited and practice something without devotion, then the more you learn, the more proud you become, and the more confused you become. So the development of knowledge is a good condition for Vipassana, and it comes through truly learning. So, returning to stress management. We've talked about a lot of things, right? We've talked about the fact that some of the more non-spiritual, non-dharma ways of working with stress are helpful, and we should do them. We should exercise. We should do physical therapy and mental therapy and things like that. That stuff can help. That stuff is not a permanent solution. Because of the nature of the habits we have built up over such a long time, we aren't starting out with a peaceful mind. And so whatever we achieve and whatever circumstance we bend to our wills will not ultimately make us happy, because we will simply become dissatisfied with that new circumstance and ultimately move along. I mean, you can crave a new car, right? You get that new car and you're really excited about it. It gets a ding in it and suddenly you're all frustrated and because somebody wasn't mindful and dinged your car, right? And you might go get that one fixed, but pretty soon you have three more and you don't get those fixed. And a few years down the line, you know, you've got fast food wrappers inside the back seat. And, you know, I've got kids, especially this time of year, is just total destruction on the interior of a car as they get in with snow and slush. And not today, but a week from now when that slush is black, you know, it's a no-win proposition, right? Because we live in an impermanent world. We live in a constantly changing and, in the example of the car, degrading situation. And so pretty soon that car is the old car that you're trying to get rid of and you're craving that next new one. So there is no permanent solution outside of us. Rinpoche says that stress management is a very nice term, but it's not an end in itself, because you are constantly still managing. Stress management implies that you have stress and you're just trying to manage it. You're just trying to move things around so that it's a little better for yourself. He said the point is to work with your mind such that you don't have to manage it anymore. He said, stress management is a path, but it's not the fruition, to put it in dharmic terms. He said, it's just like meditation. He said, we don't meditate to become meditation champions. We meditate so that we don't have to meditate anymore. We only meditate because we're working with the suffering that the meditation is the it helps us solve. So we're meditating so we don't have any more defilements and discursiveness and neurosis. And the result of some of those are stress. When we totally manifest our ultimate essence, the Buddha essence, the limitless potential, when it fully manifests, then we don't have to meditate anymore. And when we completely develop a peaceful mind, then we don't have to manage our stress anymore. And as a review, we do that by first developing that stable, peaceful mind through shamatha. And then we move on to special insight, which can take all of the circumstances that we experience and transform them into wisdom. And that way, those very circumstances that we were trying to escape, those very things we were trying to change, those very things that we labeled as the barrier to that keeps me from being happy, I will be happy when those are gone. Those actually can become the key to waking up and to moving beyond that cycle of suffering and those habits and of conditioned mind that cause that suffering. Taisi Tu Rinpoche says that the world is worse now than it was 20 years ago, or 10, or 5. Now, this book's 8 or 10 years old, too, so he hasn't seen anything, right? He doesn't know what it's like now. but he says we can pray and do our part by doing shamatha and vipassana meditation so that we'll be able to contribute a little bit for the betterment of everybody, which is peace of mind. So I hope this has been helpful. We've got plenty of time for questions and a microphone to go up and talk. Feel free to talk about anything, to ask anything, and I'll do my best to answer. But also, I'd kind of like to hear from you. If you have specific strategies or things that work for you for resolving your stress and your daily life stress, dharmic, non-dharmic, any of them, because we're not in a place to say, I'm only going to use dharma methods I'm only going to do shamatha and vipassana. No, that's not where we are. We need to work skillfully with our minds and whatever we can do. I said Buddhism is practical. Let's hear it from you. What works for you? So, Ron.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a memory of Taisi Tu Rinpoche. I think I saw him at KTD in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said that book is like 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so that explains why he talks about suicide in the book. I remember there was like some nurse asking a question. something really, a really hard question, like how do I deal with somebody who wants to commit suicide?
Mm.
And he was like, oh, I don't know, because the Tibetans, the Tibetans mainly are like escaping from China because they fear death.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to imagine what person who wants to commit suicide is thinking, and he was like, He says, well, sometimes I think about other creatures, like you see an ant, and you try to imagine what it's like being an ant. And so you like put your finger and you can like redirect an ant's trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, imagine like a giant finger coming out from the sky trying to squash you, and you want mm-hmm. that's what it's like being in Tibet. And I just thought that's so funny.
Wow.
The guy's funny like that.
Mm-hmm. No, he really is. I mean, I don't even say half of his metaphors. He can get really.
So I could tell that was.
Yeah.
Post
probably
when I saw him.
Right, he's had a lot more exposure to Western culture. You know, the Western psychology teaches us about a hierarchy of needs, right? And if you're in a situation where your physical life is constantly in danger, then on the one hand, we talk about, you know, that makes it very difficult for Dharma practice, things like that. It really can constrain what can manifest for you. But at the same time, as we progress higher and higher up that hierarchy and have more and more of our needs met, we have fewer constraints. But I think, and I am not a psychologist, by the way, this is totally off the cuff. With fewer constraints, it's kind of, we're open to almost anything. I mean, we talk about the limitlessness of mind, and the more of our, base human needs that are met, the more we have that available to us at any given point in time, either good or bad. And we talked about that here, where Taisitu Rinpoche talked about the limitlessness of mind, which is usually talked about in the context of waking up and our limitless potential to wake up. But he talked about it in terms of, we also have a limited potential to be stressed. And I think that's fascinating. So, yes. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Thank you, Marcus, for your talk today.
Mm-hmm.
Something that came to mind about contentment is Bardo Tuka Rinpoche has a book called Living in Compassion, and he talks about cultivating contentment in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's specifically in regards to being in like a marriage situation with his, where he was going with it. But then he said it can also spin out to the rest of your life with friends and coworkers and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, I'll try it. And it totally works. It's just really nice. So someone said to me once, well, can you practice 15 minutes of joy per day? And I was like, no, that sounds ridiculous. And I did it, and it works, right? So then it said do the same thing with contentment. And I tried it, and it worked. And so it's not every day I'm content, but I know I have that ability to cultivate contentment if I work at it and am aware of it or conscious of it. And then the day tends to go a lot better, regardless of the destructions around me, of everyone creating their samsara and whatever. It's just fun. But I also know that, you know, I can sit down at the end of the day for 30 minutes and cultivate some contentment, and it's just beautiful. So I'm happy I'm here. Thanks.
Thank you. That is nice. Very nice. So how would you... I won't put Josh on the spot, but think about that. How would you cultivate contentment? I know one thing we often do is recognizing whenever there's something good in our lives, we express gratitude for it, and then we dedicate that to all beings. We dedicate it to our teachers, things like that. And in that way, you really can develop, I think, a gratefulness. I see Lama Kathy on social media do that in the spring when she sees, you know, the first daffodils coming up, and she's dedicating those to the happiness of all beings. And I think that's, you know, that's just fantastic. It's a real fantastic exercise. So, yes, thank you.
I don't know if this is excuse me. I don't know if this is a question or just so that this interaction would lead to an answer. But
sure.
I might have answered a little bit myself as I was thinking about it. So I understand the bullseye and the target. That's mm-hmm. awesome. But to be productive, you know, in this society,
mm-hmm.
Like goals mm-hmm. and then mileposts of mm-hmm. growth, it seems to be there's like a fine line
mm-hmm.
of the whole target concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it'd be dangerous to get into like being apathetic mm-hmm. and complacent.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I'm just wondering like what your take on that is, that line between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of answered it myself as I was thinking about it and I was writing it down, that it would be the process that we should mm-hmm. maybe
mm-hmm.
not concentrate on, but to appreciate,
right,
as opposed to that end constantly, mm-hmm. that end. But would it turn into a dangerous thing where we turn into like a process junkie? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
I was thinking, and no. It was just looping, and
mm-hmm.
so I just wanted to know. I just wanted to open a dialogue with you about that.
Right,
I guess.
Right. So I had a few thoughts while you were saying that. Number one, I'm just at the very beginning of reading a book that's fantastic, and I don't know if I can recommend it when I've read like one chapter, but it's called Atomic Habits, and I don't even remember the author's name, but it's a fairly new book, and he's basically talking about that. He says, basically, you favor systems over goals. And so he's basically saying the best way even to be successful on whatever metric you make is to just make tiny atomic, you know, smallest unit of measure, tiny changes. In other words, design your days for how you fill your time. Design that with minor tweaks over and over. And that's actually going to lead you where you want to go better than setting a goal and working hard and working hard and working hard to get there. So that's one thing that one answer I would have. Another answer is to recognize that we often aren't quite as nuanced when we talk about a healthy relationship to ego as maybe we should be. We kind of think about doing away with our ego. What we're doing away with is our attachment to ego, our servitude to ego. And so when it comes to ego, we need that to function in the world. We need some understanding that I'm here and my boss is there and there's a little bit of separation there and we've got to understand that. We need that to function in a way that's going to take care of our families and things like that. So I think the trick is that we practice to overcome our attachment and our grasping after things that, quite honestly, can become neurotic. So if we are thinking about, I want to do this in my career, number one, if we're looking way down the line and not just adjusting those small habits and working on the process, like you said, number one, we're not working with that as skillfully as we could be. But number two, if we leave that unexamined and we fall into our normal habit of grasping after the ego in a way that we're not going to be happy until we achieve that, then that's where we're perpetuating it. It does not mean that you should not develop and succeed in you know, normal aspects of life in your working world. You want to be as good as you can. So yeah, those are the kind of the two thoughts I had. Number one, just like you said, process instead of goals. Working mindfully with your day-to-day present moment is actually going to be more effective in the long run at meeting those goals, number one. And number two, you're going to be better able to practice contentment all along the way anyway. And number two, to recognize that once we develop skillfulness in getting rid of our grasping after our egos, then our egos can actually be servants of our minds that can get the perspective on things that we need and can say, developing my career, developing in the working world is something that is very useful to me, not mistaking it for what's going to bring me happiness because it feeds my ego, because it creates a circumstance and bends that circumstance to what I think will help me out. So I think it's a change in perspective that way.
Thanks.
So, thank you.
Thanks for the perspective, the atomic thing.
Mm-hmm.
That for me, how I digested that, and I'm still going to digest it for a while, think of process it, that the whole thing of getting caught up in just the process, that could be a dangerous thing too for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the atomic thing actually helps to put into perspective, as in the tiny little things that make up the process. Because the process will then turn into a goal, and then that would be crazy, right?
Right, exactly.
So, no, that's awesome. Thanks.
Exactly, and we're talking about that in terms of normal life things, but this absolutely applies to Dharma. I was actually talking to Michael about this beforehand. I don't know if you've heard the term that was coined, I think, by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, spiritual materialism. So we can do all these neuroses that we bring to ambition, for example, to our working world, we can bring those same things to our meditative practice, right? And we can be looking down the road at enlightenment and, oh, I've got to get enlightened, right? And when it doesn't happen in a few months, we lose motivation and give up and stop, right? And stop our practice. So absolutely, in the same way, adjusting our habits to, Rinpoche mentions, basically creating the right conditions for good shamatha, practicing good shamatha, and working out how we're going to facilitate that on a daily basis rather than on a I'm going to get enlightened basis. Adjusting our motivation to realize that we can do this for the benefit of all beings and that we can begin to benefit them now. And that our meditation practice, as we develop peace of mind, will have an impact on those around us. Then suddenly it's not something that we may accomplish in this lifetime or maybe a few lifetimes from now when we get enlightened, but we're actually working that out and working with that change in motivation and that practice all along the way. So, thank you. Excellent question. All right. Well, if that's it, I'll let everyone get back to sledding, and we'll go ahead and dedicate the merit. Thank you for being here today and listening to the words of Thay Sithu Rinpoche. So, may the merits gained from coming here to learn, from developing peace of mind, that leads to special insight, and from transforming our normally stressful mind and this feeling of being overwhelmed into wisdom and moving toward enlightenment, that one day we may be able to benefit all beings through our example. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.